This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, April 24th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, we'll go to Syria, where violence and attacks continue despite the presence of international observers and promises to implement a UN-backed ceasefire. In the U.S., protesters converge on the Department of Justice to call for an end to the death penalty and mass incarceration. And a federal agency strengthens protections for transgender people in the workplace.
This is really significant because it's a federal ruling, and so it has impact on especially the 34 states where it's still legal to not hire or fire someone because they're transgender, simply for being who they are.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Riot troops fired tear gas and stun grenades on thousands of mourners at a funeral procession in Bahrain yesterday. Pictures of Salah Abbas Habib, found dead Saturday, reveal what appears to be birdshot wounds and severe burns on his torso. Reports from the opposition, Al-Wafaq, say his neck was also broken. Jonathan Miller was with a British news crew deported from the Mideast island nation on Sunday. He says the Bahraini police used tear gas canisters as weapons against protesters.
They are actually killing people with tear gas canisters, believe it or not. And it's the stench of this revolution, it is the smell of this little revolt, because the streets just reek of tear gas.
In northern Bahrain, protesters today are calling for the immediate release of 14 activists jailed on charges of trying to overthrow the government, including Abdul Hadi Al-Khawaja, who is on day 76 of a hunger strike. Yesterday, their appeal was delayed until April 30th. Al-Khawaja's daughter, Zainab, was arrested over the weekend while protesting during the Formula One Grand Prix race. Her lawyer announced today that she'll be detained for 1 week. In India, today marks a high point in the wedding season and a low point for many children, some as young as five, who will be married. But under orders from the central government, so-called flying squads are prepared to crash ceremonies and verify the ages of the bride and groom. Sharia Niazi has more.
Today is Akshay Tritiya or Akha Tij, an auspicious Hindu day to get married. And states like Madhya Pradesh, with its high rate of child marriages, thousands of kids wed each year on this day. According to the most recent household survey, around 29% of girls in the state and 40.5% of boys get married below the legal age of 18 years for girls and 21 years for boys. But a public awareness campaign is underway to prevent child marriages in all the districts of the state, and local officials have set up squads to deter parents from marrying off their minor children. Child marriage is illegal in India, and jail terms or fines can be imposed under the Child Marriage Prevention Act 1929. But many villagers are not fully aware of the Act's provisions, and therefore child marriages are rarely reported. Shura Niazi, FSRN, Bhopal.
A leader among female Palestinian prisoners, Lina Al-Jarboni, was transferred to solitary confinement today after refusing to abandon a hunger strike. The representative for imprisoned Palestinian women is among at least 1,200 people in Israeli jails who began fasting last week to protest conditions of their detention. Local media reports that many have been transferred and isolated, had their possessions confiscated, and are now denied all family visits. Yesterday, an Israeli court turned down appeals from two Palestinian prisoners who've been on hunger strike for 56 days. Bilal Diab and Thayer Halala have been held without charge on administrative detention since last summer. The judge said the men were responsible for their state of health. They're both hospitalized, their conditions both rapidly deteriorating. Nigeria's parliament is considering recommendations in a report that reveals almost $7 billion went missing from the country's fuel subsidy program. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
The parliament has so far accepted a number of recommendations in the government's report, which called for the prosecution of those involved in the fraud and repayment of $6.8 billion, which was stolen within the last 3 years. Among the report findings were more than 100 importers who were paid millions of dollars yet never imported any fuel, senior government officials and highly placed individuals with links to the government were involved in the fraud, as were Nigeria's oil management company and the state-run Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation. The removal of fuel subsidies triggered nationwide protests earlier this year, after which some of the price supports were returned and prices at the pump came down a bit. Even though the country is Africa's largest oil importer, the majority of the populace remain desperately poor. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
The U.S. government released its annual report on the solvency of Social Security and Medicare yesterday. In 2010 and 2011, Social Security spent more than it made for the first time since the early 1980s. 8 years from now, the trust will have to tap into assets to pay benefits, and those assets will run out by 2033. After that, taxes will pay for only about 75% of benefits through the mid-2080s. That's the combined projection. The disability insurance program on its own is projected to run out 4 years from now. As for Medicare, according to the trustee's report, it will run out of cash in 2024, and that's assuming the cost savings mandated by the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act will be put in place. The trustees called on Congress to act swiftly to soften the impact on low-income Americans and those already dependent on program benefits. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Doreen Marina in Los Angeles. Today in Syria, activists report heavy gunfire from government forces in homes and other cities as state media said a car bomb exploded in the capital, Damascus. Activists with the local coordination committees report shelling and shooting near a hospital checkpoint in Hama and updated the death toll from yesterday's violence to 80 across the country. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said it documented 28 people killed just in Hama. The violence continues as a small advance team of United Nations observers visits cities in the country as part of a ceasefire plan that has done little to stem the bloodshed. FSRN's David Enders reports from Syria.
Despite a UN-brokered ceasefire, the shelling and fighting between armed rebels known as the Free Syrian Army and the government of President Bashar al-Assad continues. The violence has driven hundreds of thousands of Syrians from their homes and destroyed vital infrastructure. The towns and villages between the Lebanese border and Homs, the country's third largest city, have come under increasing pressure from the Syrian military as it has tried to cut rebel supply lines. Government troops have shelled parts of Homs heavily for more than 2 months in an attempt to dislodge the Free Syrian Army. For the people in this rural area outside of Homs, the ceasefire has meant little. A few refugees were returning to their homes last week, but not many. One family was coming back to the village of Abel, about 3 miles from the outskirts of Homs. Like many of the houses in the village, theirs had been shelled.
The tanks came and hit the houses. One girl was killed over there.
The Syrian military had taken over the nearby village of Al-Mubarakia, destroying a number of houses and preventing thousands from returning after a battle there between the army and the Free Syrian Army in mid-March. Motassem Idris is a fighter from Al-Mubarakia.
The people were given 30 minutes to return to get what they could from their houses. Nothing is left. The water tanks have been shelled and the electrical lines have all been destroyed. The village is unlivable.
In the nearby city of Al-Qusair, the last urban rebel stronghold in this part of the country, residents demonstrate almost daily. Despite heavy shelling at times, the fighters have managed to repel the Syrian military each time it has attempted to invade the city since March. Mohammed Idris is the leader of a group of fighters who withdrew from Homs in late February and are now in Al-Qusair, making plans to expand their fight against the military.
Now we are organizing ourselves and creating a military council. We will attack the Syrian army and their bases and their checkpoints and try to capture their weapons. We are also training fighters. We have many new volunteers without military experience.
We make this light for surgery. This is not a surgical light.
The remaining civilians here have suffered heavily. Al-Qusair's hospital has been occupied by government troops for months, forcing people to rely on a field hospital for care. As the Syrian military has tightened its control of the border with Lebanon, the injured must now be evacuated on motorbikes. A doctor at the makeshift medical facility inside a home in Al-Qusair said the situation had resulted in a number of deaths due to otherwise treatable conditions.
Last month, we have about 400 wounded. We have in last month 34 martyrs. And we have every day another patient, another operation. We do operation. Some patient we cannot do anything for them in this hospital. We transfer to Lebanon.
The cemetery in Al-Qusair has pre-dug graves in case people need to be buried while the city is being shelled. Last week, hundreds marched through the streets of Al-Qusair for the funeral of a man killed by shelling, filling one of the pre-dug graves. A month ago, the fighters here said they would withdraw before giving the military a reason to continue shelling the city heavily, but now they say they will remain to fight. David Enders, FSRN, Syria.
The U.S. prison system is demanding more tax dollars and incarcerating more people than ever before. Critics of the system, including former prisoners and activists with the Occupy movement, gathered today in Washington, D.C. to demand major changes, including the abolition of solitary confinement, torture, and the death penalty. FSRN's Alice Olstein was at the Justice Department and files this report.
The new Jim Crow has got to go! The new Jim Crow has got to go! The new Jim Crow!
Outside the Justice Department, a crowd of people from all over the country gathered Tuesday morning to call attention to what they see as the injustices of incarceration in the U.S. Young and older activists, some wearing orange jumpsuits to show solidarity with prisoners and some wearing Black Panther buttons, listened as speakers described the racial and socioeconomic dynamics of jails in the U.S. and called for sweeping changes. The first was Yango Sawyer, a former prisoner and founder of the Coalition of Returning Citizens.
We are the people who believe in freedom. We are the people who believe in justice. We are the people who believe that mass incarceration is the war on Black and brown people in particular and poor people in general.
The rally was timed to coincide with the 58th birthday of prisoner and activist Mumia Abu-Jamal, who spent nearly 30 years on death row before being moved to the general prison population last January. The group Occupy the Justice Department is demanding the release of Abu-Jamal and political prisoners around the country. Joined by actor Danny Glover, the musicians from Dead Prez, and other famous activists, they also called for the abolition of solitary confinement, torture, and the death penalty, and an end to the war on drugs and the jailing of undocumented people. Later in the day, several activists were arrested for blocking the street in downtown Washington. D.C. native Usman Hussein came to Tuesday's protest with his wife and youngest son, who rode on his shoulders waving a striped flag representing the strength of African people.
Black is the people, red is the blood, and green is the land.
Hussein said raising his two sons in a country that puts so many African-American men behind bars motivates him to protest and advocate for change.
I'm very concerned that eventually they're going to become a victim of this racial caste system being created in this country. Mass incarceration, the war on drugs being fought in the inner city, African American and neighborhoods of lower economic status.
The rally comes as Congress considers funding the expansion of the U.S. prison system. The president's 2013 budget gives the Federal Bureau of Prisons nearly $280 million more than last year. And though a small amount of that is for drug rehabilitation and other programs, much of the money is slated for expanding federal prison capacity and contracting new private prisons.
Even in time of fiscal crisis, at a time when crime rates are declining, it's disturbing that federal prison system continues to expand, continues to build prisons.
That's Mark Maurer with the Sentencing Project. He says long mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenses have led to an explosion in the U.S. prison population, which has increased more than 700% in 40 years.
We have 500,000 people behind bars for drug offense. The vast majority of them are not the so-called kingpins of the drug trade, but typically street corner sellers, couriers, so-called mules and the like. These are people in the lower levels of the drug trade, and incarcerating them by the tens of thousands has had no impact on the availability or price of drugs, but it's been extremely expensive and one of the main factors contributing to the expansion of the prison system.
Maurer recently joined other advocates in petitioning Congress to consider cheaper and more humane alternatives to incarceration instead of using prison sentences as the default punishment for every crime. But prison reform activists have claimed some victories this year. Connecticut lawmakers voted earlier this month to repeal the death penalty in the state, though they say prisoners will still live out their lives in death penalty-like conditions. And California's Secretary of State announced Monday that activists gathered enough signatures to put a death penalty repeal measure on November's ballot. If the referendum passes, the sentences of more than 700 people would be commuted to life in prison without parole. And the more than $170 million the state spends every year maintaining death row would be reallocated to solving open rape and murder cases. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
In a decision that strengthens employment protections for transgender people, a federal agency has ruled that discrimination based on gender identity is a violation of federal law. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission found that protections under Title VII, a federal law protecting workers from sex discrimination, can apply to the case of a transgender woman who was denied a job at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. Mia Macy had disclosed her gender transition midway through the application process. For more on the findings in this case, we're joined by Mark Snyder, communications manager at the Transgender Law Center. The center represented Macy in the case. Mark Snyder joins us from San Francisco. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you so much for having me.
First, talk about the case that came before the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Who is Mia Macy and what happened during the hiring process?
Sure. Well, Mia Macy is a veteran and a former police detective, and she was denied a job as a ballistics technician at the Walnut Creek, California laboratory of the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, otherwise known as ATF, after coming out as transgender. So, you know, she was an exceptionally qualified candidate for the position, and with her military and law enforcement background. And she was also one of the few people in the whole country that specialized in and that had the training in this specific ballistics computer system. She initially applied for the position as male because she was in the early stages of transitioning, and she had not yet legally changed her name. The ATF lab director told her that she was virtually guaranteed to get the job, and she would just have to go through the formality of a background check. After she disclosed her gender transition midway through the hiring process, she was suddenly told that the funding for the position had been cut. And she later learned that somebody else had been hired for the job. So we helped her file a discrimination complaint with ATF, and the case eventually got brought to the EEOC.
And the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which came out with this conclusion, they concluded that discrimination against transgender individuals, discrimination under Title VII does include gender identity, change of sex, and or transgender status that's recognized under Title VII. What's significant about this finding?
You know, courts have recognized for many years that discrimination because someone doesn't fit narrow gender stereotypes of what a man or a woman ought to be like is a type of sex discrimination. Discrimination against transgender people is always in some sense rooted in other people's views that transgender people don't fit their idea of how like a man or a woman should be. And this is really significant because it's a federal ruling, and so it has impact on especially the 34 states where it's still legal to hire or fire someone because they're transgender, simply for being who they are. So we think this is a really big deal for the transgender community nationwide, and it's the first time, really, that the EEOC has ruled in this way.
You mentioned the 34 states that still have laws in the books that allow for this kind of discrimination. Talk for a moment about the challenges that transgender people face, even under the law, when applying for jobs.
Well, transgender people face extraordinarily high rates of discrimination in the workplace and in the community, and violence. In 2011, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force did a survey, and 78% of respondents to that survey, it was the largest survey of transgender people to date, 78% reported experiencing at least one form of harassment or mistreatment at work because of their gender identity. Also, three-fourths of voters support protecting transgender people from workplace discrimination. So we think, you know, this is a sea change, this decision, and it's a part of a growing trend among Americans as well.
And legally, what does this ruling mean for other similar cases, for other people who face this kind of discrimination? How could it be applied?
Well, a decision from the EEOC is binding on EEOC offices and investigators throughout the country. So, you know, there's EEOC offices all over. And now if a transgender person is discriminated against on the job, they can go to their local office and they'll know that they're protected by federal law.
And how about for the case of Mia Macy? What's next in that specific complaint?
Now the investigation will return to the ATF and they will have to apply this law. They will have to apply this to the investigation that, yes, indeed, transgender people are protected by Title VII as we had said in our complaint.
So you'll be watching to see how this is implemented.
Correct.
Mark Snyder is communications manager at the Transgender Law Center. He joined us to discuss the decision by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission to recognize discrimination protections for transgender people under federal law. Mark Snyder, thank you for your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This is Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Grassroots struggles and victories are part of our everyday reporting. From the Philippines to Nigeria to Mexico, from Arizona to Wisconsin to Louisiana, the power of the grassroots is everywhere, and it comes from the power of listeners like you. We depend on a community to bring global voices to the air. Find out how you can support grassroots journalism at fsrn.org. On May 1st, people all over the world will mark the International Workers' Day with events and actions related to social justice and workers' rights. In New York City, labor unions, immigrant and community-based organizations, and protesters from Occupy Wall Street have come together to coordinate a mass strike and cultural events. It's the result of a long-term campaign. FSRN's Caroline Lewis has been following the efforts and reports from New York.
This year's rallying cry, A Day Without the 99%, is an echo of A Day Without Immigrants, the slogan that drove more than a million people to strike and march in cities across the country on May 1st, 2006. Local activists remember thousands of people converging on Union Square in New York City, and many credit that May Day with reviving the observation of International Workers' Day in the United States. This year's events are shaping up to go beyond the traditional rally and march. Diego Ibanez came to New York from Utah last fall to join Occupy Wall Street. For months, Ibanez and other occupiers have been working closely with existing immigrant and worker groups in the city to plan a full day of activities for May 1st, ranging from picket lines to a concert to educational activities like a Know Your Rights workshop.
What happens is every May, there's a May 1st coalition that organizes at Union Square. And, you know, it's a rally and it's a lot of speakers and people go to that. But, like, and the cops already know it's coming and, you know, the local news covers it. And that's May 1st. And then May 2nd comes and that's it. I think it was very important to, like, get people on board with a message that this is going to be a different kind of May Day.
The May 1st coalition has been planning May Day in New York for the past several years. One longtime member, Charles Jenkins, is the director of organizing at the Transport Workers Union Local 100. Jenkins says Occupy Wall Street was an obvious ally for his union.
It's been natural. Going back 6 months, my union, TWU, was the first union to go out and support Occupy Wall Street, and others followed. So this has been a building relationship since 2011. So to have a United May Day just came together. So it was only right to, on May Day, a Workers' Rights Day, really show all different segments of people that represent or speak for the working class united.
The collaboration does present some new challenges, though. Teresa Gutierrez is also a member of the May 1st Coalition and an advocate for immigrant rights.
We are not as confident as we have been in other years that the immigrant community will come out on May Day. And part of that is, of course, the overwhelming repression that immigrants have faced in the last few years. The fact that 1 million workers have been deported since 2008.
Gutierrez says that some people are concerned that the presence of Occupy Wall Street will increase the risk of arrest.
The May 1st Coalition does think that it's very important for our coalition to be in alliance with the Occupy Wall Street movement, even though some individuals and immigrants organizations have expressed concern about this association because of the level of repression against the OWS movement. In a population where a young white person might go to jail for 24 hours in a altercation with the police, an immigrant will get deported if they have no papers.
Gutierrez says that she is working with members of different Occupy working groups to ensure that they will have safety marshals present at the march who will be in charge of communicating the authorized boundaries to those involved. The majority of the march route has already been authorized by the NYPD. Jenkins is working with them to authorize the last part of the route, which was originally planned to go past Wall Street, ending in Battery Park.
We've met with NYPD. This is always a big undertaking, so we're sure that there'll be a large police present. We were denied the end of the march route, which was Battery Park. And so we're still negotiating with the NYPD in terms of the end. We intend to march from Union Square down to Wall Street, Wall Street being the target of capitalism, Wall Street being the target of the 1%. And so we have to march past Wall Street to demonstrate that 99% is bigger than 1%.
While some are planning to strike on May 1st, organizers scheduled the march for early evening so that people who do go to work will have a chance to participate. Caroline Lewis, FSRN, New York.
Today is the first in a week-long series of labor stories on FSRN, including special programming on May Day, when our partners in the media consortium are putting together a day-long TV video broadcast. See live dispatches from FSRN reporters and others, in-studio analysis, a Storify, and a special interactive map taking you where news is happening in real time. That's Tuesday, May 1st, International Workers Day at FSRN.org. That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. And remember, the power of the grassroots comes from the power of listeners like you. We depend on a community to bring global voices to the air. Find out how you can support grassroots journalism at fsrn.org. Thanks for listening today in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.